You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
One of Us is a podcast and video network funded all but entirely by donations and subscriptions. We do accept pitches for audio-based or banner ads, but on a case-by-case basis. If you are interested in that, contact us at oneofusnet@gmail.com. With the amount of audio and video content we generate, it is expensive and extremely time-consuming to keep things running. Please go to the webpage oneofus.net and sign up for a subscription at $2, $5, $10, or $25 and get a ton of bonus content. One of Us needs and appreciates all your support.
Special episode of Digital Noise.
You stole my bike.
It was never your bike to begin with. It was always the bike of my people.
I don't know why I went to that immediately. All my bikes were stolen. You know what? Actually, I can tell you why. It's because of the Different Strokes episode. That's the first thing that popped in my head. And then I was like, well, I'm not going to open the show with like SA. I'm not going to open the show with like child abuse.
Yeah, no, I wasn't.
So I was like, bike store, you stole my bike. But the most special of all very special episodes is the child abuse episode of Different Strokes.
Well, yeah,
it's sobering. Maybe it's so dark.
Maybe the most famous.
Because it's so at odds with the tone of the show.
Yeah,
it'd be like Gilligan's Island having that.
It makes you wonder. You're like, did Different Strokes get caught doing drugs and it was sentenced to do this episode?
It's like all 80s sitcoms try to like one up each other with like some
poignant episode.
Yeah, it's weird. I wonder when the last sitcom to do that was.
I think the only ones that the episodes still hold up as poignant and not corny are MASH.
Yeah.
Those are the only ones where you're like, oh, this still works. But that had a different...
One thing for a show just to have a more dramatic episode. It's another thing for it to be like, tonight, on a very special home improvement, like that whole thing.
Yeah.
But I am curious historically what the last like social issue, very special episode sitcom was, because it doesn't seem like they still have them. Like I can't imagine them being like tonight on a very special Young Sheldon or Two and a Half Men. You know, it's like
I can't remember the last time I watched anything with a laugh track, so I don't know. Like I know they still exist,
yeah,
but
oh, for me probably. It's probably been Raymond.
Oh, everybody loves Raymond.
And that's been years.
Yeah, it's been off the air for quite some time.
Yeah. That may be the last laugh track sitcom I ever watched. I didn't watch... I know that Netflix had, like...
I'd like to watch an episode here or there of that. Same with Home Improvement. I'd be like, I've seen a few episodes of it. But, you know, it was already past the point that I was like, I'm kind of done with this.
The Ashton Kutcher sitcom that was on Netflix was, like, filmed before a live studio audience. It had, like...
Right, the one that also had the rapist guy on it.
Yeah, and it was like R-rated language in a sitcom format, which was also really jarring.
Yeah.
It was like you had because it felt like crappy TV, but then they were dropping F-bombs, and it's like, I have cognitive dissonance. Like, this is not the way it's supposed to be.
That is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard it wasn't very good, though.
Well, it's not around anymore, but that doesn't mean anything for Netflix.
Yeah.
It could be great and not be around anymore.
That's very true. but we are not actually talking about it. I don't think any television this time, right? No, we don't have any TV on this week's show. It's just movies, and boy, are they all over the place this week.
That's true.
But I figured, John Golson, that we're going to start off with one that everybody loves, which is The Warriors, the Walter Hill movie that keeps getting reissued. Arrow, finally getting around to doing their own version of it, puts out what I would say is the definitive version of it, because the previous Blu-ray edition of it was just the
ultimate director's cut, which is definitely not. It's an old Walter Hill going, you know, not so many people have said it. This, I think I did originally mean to make this more comic-y and added all these comic panel transfers.
It's the
and
first
stuff.
Time I saw it was that way.
Really? Yeah. Oh my goodness.
First time I saw it was with the comic book interstitials and transitions.
Not as good. That version is also available here, but the main focus here is the original, which has been fixed up to 4K and is quite beautiful.
I don't... We'll get into it. I don't think that the comic book stuff works the way that he thinks it does, because I think he's like, oh, it was always intended to be like a quasi street fantasy. And I don't think that, I think you perceive that when you're watching the movie. So the grittier and more realistic it feels, the better the movie is, because you know, it's already a step outside of our reality. So mm-hmm. as long as it feels, again, like street level, it's sort of like, that's what makes it really good. To be like, oh, it's fantasy and reinforce that, reduces the grittiness, and yeah. it makes it not as good. And yeah. I liked The Warriors when I saw it with the transitions, but I loved The Warriors when I saw it without the transitions.
It's a fantasy of, like, what if New York street gangs had, like, sort of samurai codes yeah. of honor and shit?
What if every 90s beat-em-up video game you ever played was reality?
Right? They all wore, like, just really cool outfits yeah. in a particular style, and yeah. No, it's... It's obviously fantasy, and, you know, the plot being, if you've never heard of this, which is possible, some people out there may have never actually seen this one. It seems weird. You and I grew up with it being sort of legendary to people older than us yeah. already, and then because I remember going like, oh, I mean, I don't think I saw this one until years after it came out.
I didn't really even, it wasn't even on my radar until going to the Draft House a lot, like back in, God, shortly after the Draft House opened. I think Draft House really... canonized The Warriors with screenings and Tyler Stout posters and stuff like that, and it was like, yeah. oh, what is this movie? And then I saw it, I guess, when it was that shortly after that comic book release of the that DVD release. So I didn't necessarily grow up with it. I was already into adulthood before it was ever on my radar.
Yeah, me as well. I remember seeing the VHS tape in stores, but never rented it because it wasn't something anybody was talking about. To me, in my friend's group anyway, back then, yeah. I agree. It really wasn't till like, you know, the late 90s when the Alamo Drafthouse card came up and everybody was like, what? It's one of the all-time greats. I'm like, I guess I should see it then.
They used to get in when I worked at Game Fellows in Barton Creek Mall, the employees there would get into Warriors versus the Wanderers.
Oh, geez.
And I've never seen The Wanderers.
It is a very different vibe.
Okay. But that was like, our manager, he loved The Wanderers and didn't love The Warriors. And like... anytime anybody talked about loving The Warriors or said, Warriors, come out to play, yay, he would be like, Wanderers is way better.
Oh, boy. You're just like, no, please don't do it. Oh,
Wanderers looks kind of Sha-na-na.
It's very Sha-na-na.
Okay.
Yeah. A lot more like Greasers. Yeah. It's like if Grease like had more of an action vibe to it. Anyway, so here, the most powerful gang in New York, the leader of it has decided that he's going to gather all the gangs together and like say, hey, we all got to work together because there's so many people working against us. We got to stop infighting and all that. And then someone assassinates him.
Is that what he says? Or does he say, can you dig it?
Well, he says both things. Okay. he gets killed, and the guy who kills him, Luther, who's played by the always memorable character actor David Patrick Kelly,
yeah,
basically really. Goes, hey, it was him, that guy from The Warriors who did it, who Michael Beck, who I know best as the love interest in Xanadu, but yeah. whatever. You know, you have your Warriors, I have my Olivia Newton-John roller skating. And so the Warriors have to trek all the way across New York back to their borough, which is Coney Island, escaping all these gangs who are out for their blood. And the whole thing is apparently based on a Greek play. So it's like, okay. And then that's why there's the DJ who's sort of the Greek chorus narrator.
I've never
and stuff.
Heard this.
Yeah. And there's like at one point you see somebody reading a comic book that has the title of the original play in it. And like, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff like that in there. There's little nods here and there with the names, like Cyrus apparently is the character in the original play is named Cyrus, stuff like that. Yeah. And it's very, it makes New York look super gritty. As it was at the time, certainly in 1979, but there is a sense of like, you know, just a fantasy adventure trip, you know, I mean, they could have substituted these gangs for like monsters and it would have been the same thing basically.
Yeah. It's really, it just has like a vibe. Like we talk about this, I will occasionally bring up this idea that, like, sometimes movies feel like almost like living, breathing things. I realize how crazy this sounds on the podcast right now. But, like, Warriors is so singular. Like, it feels... It just operates on its own frequency. And it's really, really cool. And again, I don't think I picked up on that frequency with the comic book stuff.
Yeah.
For the reasons I stated, plus the fact that the technology is also so obviously not of the time.
Yeah.
Like the stuff that they use. So without all that stuff, like, it really clicked into place. And it's also one of those movies where it's like, I like that, much like when we talked about After Hours, a movie that I was like, this is fine, and then watched again and was like, oh, I may love this. Like, this may be a new movie that I love. And Warriors is a movie that I love. And something else, like, David Patrick Kelly is really memorable in it. He's kind of a scumbag.
He always plays a scumbag.
He's got some Spike Lee movies where he's not same flavor of scumbag.
Well, he's still a scumbag now, right?
Yeah.
Okay, just to be clear.
This is closer to, like, The Crow.
I was saying, I think of him in The Crow going, this is a really real world. that was a great death. yeah, you're right. He's in Malcolm X, Crooklyn, Chirac. And yeah, that's right. He was in Wild at Heart and Twin Peaks.
Was it Deborah Van Valkenburg? Is that her name?
Yeah.
From Too Close for Comfort?
That's right. That is what she's from.
She's one of the daughters from Too Close for Comfort.
And she plays, like, please forgive the use of the word, but bimbo.
She should have been a bigger star.
Who's like, oh, no question. But she's like the bimbo who belongs to one street gang, but they can't control her. And she starts a fight with the Warriors when the street gang in question is kind of the pussy street. They're the lame street gang. So, like, oh, no, we want, even though, like, everybody's like, take out the Warriors, I don't think we could actually take them. And she's like, no, come on, let's do this shit. Fuck those guys. And then somehow ends up on the Warriors side. You're just like, okay. And ends up being sort of the traveling girl with the group across the city. But she's great in this.
Yeah, I wish she would have done more films, because I think she's so commanding in this.
I agree.
James Remar is in this in an early role as well, like a kind of a career defining role. I mean, that's probably what a lot of people recognize him from, even now, if they see him as an old man. Oh, that's that kid from the Warriors
or the bad guy from 48 Hours.
Yeah. But yeah, it's great. And it is a great box of features and versions, and it's,
oh yeah, they put together a huge box for this thing with lots of actual physical features as well, with, like we said, the theatrical cut and the ultimate director's cut, which now they've changed to calling alternate version, thankfully. But yeah, there's, like, a new commentary with a senior film critic at Film Freak Central, Walter Chaw, who wrote a whole book about Walter Hill. And he talks about all this film throughout it. There's War Stories, which is new, which is an interview with Walter Hill where he looks back at how hard it was to make this film. And how Ed Koch, actually, when there was a lot of people protesting against it, actually defended it when he was mayor of New York City, which is pretty cool, actually. Koch was cool. I always liked Koch. And then a Zoom discussion between the screenwriter Josh Olson, director Lexi Alexander, who did Punisher Warzone, and director Robert Krasowski, who did The Man Who Killed Hitler, and then The Bigfoot, which I always meant to see and never got around to, that was originally recorded for the podcast The Movies That Made Me. There's an interview with editor Billy Weber, who talks about going back and forth and working with Terrence Malick, and then moving on to Walter Hill, which had to have been a strange change. Certainly. Interview with Bobby Mannix, who is the costume designer on this and Xanadu, which you can totally kind of see.
Yeah, I can see that.
The Armies of the Night is an image gallery looking through her designs. Come Out to Play is a guided tour of the original locations in Coney Island. The last new extra is Sound of the Streets, appreciation of the score. And then there's all the archival extras that have come out before. So there's actually a lot of really good stuff here. I mean, the second disc, the alternate disc, is largely what the last re-release of it was, and all those said extras for it. But yeah, if you've never seen it, this, you know, now is the time to see it with this beautiful looking new version and sounding new version. If you have seen it before, this is the one you want to have.
Yeah.
But we'll move on to a Kino Lorber title that I had never heard of before, but when I read the all about it online, I was like, this sounds fascinating. I can't believe I've never heard of this, called I for Icarus, or alternately I as in Icarus. This version says I for Icarus on it, which is a French thriller that is not really set in France, and it's not really set in America. The director was French-American, so whatever. It's set in a made-up city.
And they show you that pretty early on. The flags are, like, a weird...
Yeah, it's a completely imaginary country that's sort of an amalgam of both countries in a way.
Yeah.
But the idea is that this is a takedown of the Warren Commission, who had declared that John F. Kennedy's killer was the only killer and there was nobody else. And, you know, that was very popularly for many decades considered to be an absolute joke and still is by many.
Yeah, and they have to get everybody... So in this, it opens with an assassination and they have to get everybody to agree on the findings of the commission regarding the assassination. Now, we, the audience, know extra information.
Yeah.
We know that there was an assassin and we know that the assassin was killed immediately after the assassin.
We know the assassin was even given a gun that didn't have bullets in it. And he's like, oh, fuck, realizing, oh, shit, they're setting me up.
Yeah.
But then someone else somewhere actually shoots the president.
Yeah. And so they have a investigation. They present the findings. It's like a huge, like 800 page, like gigantic binder of stuff. And I'm going to screw his name up. Alain. What's his last name?
Who are you thinking of?
The star?
Yves Montand.
Yves Montand. I'm sorry.
Yeah, yes. You were thinking of Alain Delon.
Yeah. Yves Montand.
I was like, wait, what?
No. I just had my French actor.
Yves Montand is one of those other great French actors.
Sorry.
Who's unrecognizable here, because usually, this is a totally different look for him.
Yeah.
He looks like Elliot Gould or something.
Yeah, everybody has to agree or the investigation gets reopened, and he's the only one that's like, I don't agree that this is how it went down. And he has hunches. And it starts, as he starts to investigate, it starts to get into, psychological manipulation. But really, the surprising part was it getting into the science of psychological manipulation.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just like Manchurian Candidate stuff where it's like, we program the sleeper agent. It was like, here is specifically how you can control people and methods of control.
Mm.
And then the movie's sort of like, what would people do with those methods of control?
I mean, I think it belongs in the same conversation with that and with The Conversation and, oh my God, what's it called? The one with Warren Beatty.
Parallax View. We watched recently Night of the Condor.
Yeah.
Three Nights of the Condor.
Yeah, yeah. 3 days of the Condor.
Three days in the Valley.
Which is 3 days. 3 days of the Condor, which is terrific.
Condor Man.
Which is, I watched that for the first time recently, too, and I was like, this is so much better than I thought it had any right to do.
Condor Man?
No, not Condor Man. Although I did also watch 2 Days in the Valley recently, which was not better than it had any right
to do. Anyways, it's just like Winter Soldier. Go ahead.
I really liked this. I didn't know where, at first, I'm like, I don't know what type of film we're watching here. But as it goes along, I'm like, ooh, I like this kind of thing where it's like, wow, they're putting together the science of it. And like, it's presenting the plausibility of this actually having been, you know, the conspiracies being true is its main goal. And then it also argues, but one of the reasons no one was willing to go this far is because, well, look at what the title is. Mm-hmm. You know, you're like, you get that, the closer you get, the more you're in danger. And everybody knew it. And it was like, that's what this film's argument clearly strongly believes, that Kennedy assassination was not as presented. But regardless of how you feel about that, this was a very enjoyable, fascinating little ride that was very different in tone from almost any other thriller I've seen like it.
Yeah, it definitely belongs in the like pantheon of 70s conspiracy thrillers. I mean, it's certainly as good as some of the ones that are viewed as classics.
Yeah.
And again, I think where it really got me was when it got into the conversations and execution of what specifically, what are the exercises needed to get someone to psychologically break down and be under your control, and then sort of moral conversations as well about what that might mean, what could you do with that?
Yeah.
It went places I didn't expect. It's very talky. As far as like spy thrillers go, it's a lot of Yves Montand, like, walking into a place he's never been before and then having lengthy conversations with the people that are there.
This is how it could have happened.
Yeah, it's a procedural. It is a procedural.
Totally.
But it's a conspiracy procedural. Again, I mean, a dark ending, a lot to chew on.
Probably more to do with, more comparable to JFK than anything else.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of this thing, it's a thriller, but not an action thriller at all.
I like it when Kino has like a little minor classic, and this feels like a, This feels like something that's worth like a reappraisal or a rediscovery.
Yeah, and in fact, in France, they loved it when it came out. It won a whole bunch of César awards and was nominated for a bunch, and it was considered a big deal there, but only there. It had a very weak, half-assed release here.
Yeah,
and I mean, it's odd for a movie like that that was definitely the attempt was made to as strongly release it here at first. No one was interested. So, what are you going to do? But it does have a commentary track with a new one with two film historians that reportedly is quite good, that really get into comparisons between the Warren Commission findings and what's in here and the history of the making of this film. And yeah, I think it's one of those, you know, it might be the type of hidden little gem that is so up your alley and you'll be glad that you gave it a chance. Then we have a new horror psychedelic film. I don't know how best to describe it, called The Fifth Thoracic Vertebra. This is an odd film that I genuinely admire this director for creating something that's unlike anything I've ever seen before. But your patience is going to vary based on how welcoming you are to the utterly inexplicably weird. At 62 minutes, you don't have to be but so patient. It's barely over an hour. But the story here, which is certainly this one critic from Screen Daily, and I thought this is the best comparison because I read a bunch of other people's reviews of this because I'm like, I got weird stuff from this, but I'm not sure how on it I am because it's so odd. Described it as the body horror of early David Cronenberg mixed with the witty eccentricity of Quentin DeBleu, which I'm like, oh, that's pretty dead on. It's like, that's a pretty good description of what this movie is, which is basically this mattress that this couple that are having serious problems are sleeping on. It's already kind of dirty, but it ends up, I guess, because of their negative energy or something, developing this horrible fungus on it. And then it starts passing through a series of other people, and the fungus is sentient and starts kind of coming out and grabbing people's vertebra out of their backs and absorbing it. And it's sort of like, I guess, building its own person inside of there. It's a very strange, and I'd also say Eraserhead is definitely a comparable piece to it in some ways. It's odd and it's funny-ish at points, but like not like ha-ha funny, just like intentionally goofy, I think, at points. But I don't know quite what to make of it still.
I've never seen anything like it, and that's rare, right? When you watch something and you're like, I don't know that I've ever seen a movie like this. About the runtime, too, it's funny. Just as the thought crossed my mind, this should have been a short, I checked the time and realized, oh, it's got like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And I was like, and then because I had no awareness of how long the movie actually was. And just when I felt like, okay, I'm ready for something new to happen, I was like, oh, it's about to end.
Yeah.
I gotta say, like, I kind of really liked it. It's a vibe movie. I think you'll either vibe with it or not. It is sort of psychedelic. I think the humor...
South Korean.
Yeah. I think the humor comes from a lot of the... it's absurd. Because it's not easily classified as a horror movie, even though the thing is, like, digging into people's spines. It's basically... The mattress is a monster... But it's a sympathetic monster that wants to make a connection and sort of like find someone who won't give it away.
Yeah.
So it's got like layers as well, like subtextual layers.
And it seems just like reacting to the negativity of human beings in a way that I couldn't quite parse out what its motivation was. And like I say, is it its motivation? Because it's clearly sentient.
Yeah.
But, or start becoming more and more sentient as the movie goes on. It's one of those films seems so drenched in pure symbolism, it's not meant to be taken any other way.
I would say it's funny, you know, in watching the stack of movies, I'm like, well, Chris is going to ask me at the end what the pick of the week is. And it's not this movie, but it also kind of is this movie, because this movie could slip through the cracks really easily. And I'm like, definitely 1,000% want to see what this director does next. I absolutely want to see what they do next. And I think if you're an adventurous movie watcher, that you might enjoy it. I would just say check your expectations in regards to, like, it's not Deathbed or, you know, any of those, like,
it's not going
killer
for,
furniture movies.
Yeah, it's not going for silly horror.
Yeah, it's way more dreamy. It's dreamlike and strange and artsy. But as dreamlike, strange, and artsy as a movie about a mattress that eats people's vertebrae could possibly be, so odd. I low key loved this.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. This director is only previously C.A. Young Park has done 3 short films before that apparently were all incredibly well received. Cash Bag in 2019, Godspeed in 2020, and The Luxury Staycation in 2021. But this is his first feature length work. And I agree with you. I'm like, they're interesting enough of a director that I both want to see those previous short films and I want to see, like, whatever comes next. In fact, will you grab the DVD? Because I could have sworn at least one of the short films was on there.
Oh,
I could be wrong.
Crinkle, crinkle.
Crinkle, crinkle. Listen, please ignore the background effects. They were edited in to give the effect of John reaching into a plastic bag to grab the movie, which of course he didn't because we were more prepared than that. Okay, so no, it does not have any special features on it that I can see. In fact, this one actually has a big tag that says review copy, not for resale on it. So who knows if maybe there's a version out there that does have that. But apparently the Austin Chronicle is one of the first people who are quoted on here as giving it a good review.
You think it's Richard or Jenny?
I mean, it could be either. Probably.
I'm going to say it's Jenny.
Really? You think it's Jenny more than Richard?
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. Anyway, we're going to move on from our special secret, don't tell anyone, pick of the week to probably not our pick of the week, but a film I've been meaning to see for a long time, House of the Long Shadows. This is a real odd film to exist at all because, A, it came out of the Canon Film Group, who weren't known overall for pursuing making real quality films. They wanted, you know, exploitative schlock, but in a higher level than, they're not like on a Troma level. I mean, what are some other Canon films, for example?
Missing in Action was a huge hit for them.
Right.
That's a big one.
There you go.
The Apple. The right. Musical, The Apple. Hey, Talking about Xanadu, there's also The Apple.
Enjoy The Apple.
I like The Apple more than Xanadu, I gotta say.
Come on now. Xanadu had an ELO score. That alone.
Anyways, the music's better in Xanadu, but I think Apple's a better movie.
All right, fair.
Anyways, Masters of the Universe, Cyborg.
They do the Enter the Ninja films, weren't those?
Probably. Let's say they did.
I don't know. But anyway, so the
Breaking,
reason... The,
Breaking and Breaking 2.
The reason is odd is because this is a little outside of their usual format. It's like the 7th remake of this book written in 1919 by a totally different title, 7 Keys to Bald Pate. You can see why they changed the name. So glad we kept that in. Anyway, the reason it's different is because this is kind of a take on the old British horror films, but as a loving tribute to it, because it's got Vincent Price, Christopher Lee, Peter Cushing, and John Carradine together for the first and only time. And they're all super old when this movie came out in 1983. You know, this is some of the last, I think it may have been Carradine's last altogether. I'm not sure, but he certainly looks like he's about to fall over. But, you know, it's a take on the cursed old house type thing, you know, certainly with references to the old Dark House, one of the original horror comedies. And it was listed as a horror comedy. The biggest problem with this film isn't with any of them. You want to see more of them for sure, but the casting of a lead of Desi Arnaz Jr., who is not really known for his huge acting skills.
Yeah.
Not terrific, really. And not even wildly charismatic either.
Almost innately unlikable on film.
Yeah. Which is weird considering how innately likable his father was.
Yeah.
You know?
I had never seen this. I'd started it. It's on Amazon. There used to be on Amazon. A lot of times a new video release will, you know, you'll notice that it's not available anymore, but it was on Amazon for a while and I'd started it and got maybe like 10, 15 minutes in and was just like, I'm not in the mood for this. Yeah. And had always kind of been like, it's interesting because online reviews for it seem to give it a reluctant pass. And I think they were more forgiving than I was. I love Peter Cushing. My cat is named after Peter Cushing.
I'm aware.
I love Christopher Lee. I love Vincent Price. I could take or leave John Carradine to be completely honest.
It depends on the role. But he's of all these, he's the one who's like probably had more work in the long run than all of them because he was also did tons of westerns and film noirs and everything. But you know, he's just not as iconic
in the monster
mind.
Stuff. He's so hammy, just as a Universal monster
it's
fan.
True.
He's such a ham.
But you want to see a film with all these guys together,
and it's not very good.
No, it's not.
It's kind of lame.
It's not.
They're not given much interesting to do. It's sort of boring.
It's not fun. It's not even really funny at all. It's like only. I think it's only a comedy because they filmed it. And went, this is dumb. We should pretend it was a comedy.
I guess it has a sort of a. I'd say the ending kind of makes it like, haha, isn't that funny?
Yeah.
But it's not a funny movie while you're watching it. But it's also not a suspenseful one or an interesting one.
The story is Desi Arnaz Jr. plays Kenneth McGee, who is a young writer who bets his publisher $20,000 that he can write a novel as good as something like Wuthering Heights in 24 hours, which I don't even Stephen King couldn't like finish a novel in 24 hours. You know, I'm like, yeah, just physically, you wouldn't have enough time to write it. Anyway, unless it's like the Black Pearl length or something, which I would not call that a novel. I'd call that a novella. Anyway, so he goes, his agent helps him out by getting him a place to be left alone, this Welsh manor that's completely deserted, supposedly, but he gets there and finds out it's not empty because apparently the descendants of the people who originally owned the place are there, and more of them keep fucking showing up. And he's like, just, well, everybody please leave me the fuck alone so I can write this book. And of course there's some shit going on with like, why are they there? What is this, the hidden reasoning that they're not being honest about? At first, they're not even telling him that they're these people, but you're like, y'all remember there's huge portraits of you all hanging in the upstairs hallway, right? Yeah. Like clearly labeled. It's not going to take the guy long to figure this out. And there's like a little sex thing too here where like, his publisher's secretary who's hot comes and is like, oh, I'm into you, but we need to leave. Cause she's just there to try and get him to like lose the bet basically. Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot of stuff in here where I'm like, you know, we talk about don't remake good movies, remake movies that could have been good.
Yeah.
This is one of those. I'm like, I could totally see this setup being really funny and really cool, but it's neither one of those here. It's just at best entertaining to the scenes where all of them are together, the classic actors, but that's all it's really got going for it.
Yeah. I don't want to see them in bad movies. I'm a big enough fan where I think it pains me to see them in crap, and this is pretty crappy.
There are a lot of extra features, though. Jesus Christ. Two audio commentaries here, one with director Pete Walker and documentarian Derek Pikett, and the other with film historian David Duval, moderated by Elijah Drenner. There is a feature-length documentary that's brand new to the United States release, House of Long Shadows Revisited. That's, I mean, the fact there's a feature-length documentary about this movie is kind of, I actually watched like 20 minutes of it just out of curiosity, and I was like, I realized I just didn't care that much.
Not everything needs to be canonized.
Yeah, I feel like this is a chapter in the book.
No pun.
It's not a documentary, you know?
Yeah.
Canonized, I get what you did there.
I didn't mean to.
Yeah. There's Pete Walker's House of Horror, which talks to the director one-on-one about making the film. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, if you're a huge, huge fan of these actors, there's no one's going to be able to talk you out of watching this. And it's not like it's painful to watch. It's just so disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's disappointing.
So we are going to, our last titles this week are all Asian movies, Hong Kong movies, which I know always makes you excited, right?
It depends. Right?
Well, actually, of these, my favorite was probably the first one we're talking about, which is the only one I'd never heard of before, which is The Blue Jean Monster. Because this is some wacky, wacky shit. And I love that the actor, the lead actor they have in here is a guy who's been in like a billion like really great Hong Kong movies, but usually playing the heavy or a cop with an attitude, but not in a good way. Who's like, antagonistic toward the good cop or whatever, usually playing a heavy, but here he's playing the hero. And, you quickly realize, oh, this is just dead heat. This is that old Joe Piscopo movie.
You want it to be that. Keep going.
I mean, not really. Dead Heat is terrible.
But I like that Dead Heat is like, It's a zombie cop movie. It's like an action comedy, buddy comedy, zombie cop.
That's
movie.
What this is.
This is like this cop, okay, and he gets a bunch of rebar dumped on top of him and some chemicals spill, and then he's basically like undead.
And maybe a magic cat. It's never clear if the cat was actually directly involved.
And he has all these powers, right? Or he's like super, he's like indestructible and super strong and has like weird electricity stuff going on.
He has to regularly get influxes of electricity or he's gonna actually die.
And you're like, oh, this is an awesome setup. This is gonna get badass. And then it's about how his pregnant wife thinks that he's not sexually interested in her. And most of the movie is devoted to that, which I'm like, he didn't even have to be a zombie for that to be the plot of the movie. Like, it's sort of like, what? I don't understand why they had to do like an undead cop just to make a movie about a woman who's like, I don't think that my husband is sexually interested in me.
Because
it's so weird.
Because, and we'll get into this with the next two films we're talking about as well, or at least one of them. Almost every 90s Hong Kong movie felt like it needed sex comedy in it. I don't know why, but they just, like, there's that point where, like, all of these films are coming out after a certain point. They're like, yeah, but what if we do sex comedy
this is like a scene.
She hires a prostitute to try and hit on him to reawaken his sexuality, which is like, what?
Yeah. You have, like, 15 minutes of action movie at the beginning and 15 minutes of action movie at the end, and the rest of it is all, why doesn't my husband, because... He is still attracted to her. It's just he's undead. And I guess that's the farce, right? Is, oh, I can't tell her I'm a member of the undead. But she, meanwhile, thinks, oh, he's not horny.
I mean, I actually thought that stuff was kind of funny here. It's dumb, but it was kind of funny dumb. And I like the goofy period piece effects and some of the choices. There's a boob popping scene.
There's a part where he has a huge gash in his stomach that he decides to cover with, like, Nutella. What is happening? You don't have gauze in your home?
But this is one of those films I was like, for a certain type of film watcher, this could be a new classic. You know what I mean? I mean, this is so much better than most of the people I know who like these sort of films champion and stuff. I'm like, I think this is one you'd really like if you saw it. Because it is bad. It's just the very watchably fun bad and so weird.
Because it's a sex farce, is the title a Chinese double entendre? Is it like the blue jean monster, meaning like the monster in his blue jeans?
Do you
get what I'm saying?
I think the idea being he's a monster who just is a human monster. I don't know.
Yeah.
It had another name, and I'm trying to figure out what it was, because this is, like, retitled, I think, for America. I can't remember what the original title was. But
it was never boring.
No, it's not boring.
So it has that going for it, but I wasn't into the sex farce stuff.
Oh, fair enough.
And that's, like, an hour of the movie.
There's an extra on the disc, Man-Made Monster, which is an interview with the assistant director for about 20 minutes. That's the main thing here. It's other than that, mainly trailers, still galleries, things like that. But like I said, it's weird that there's a film that had this guy, who's a guy whose career I actually followed, in it, and was as big a release as it apparently was somewhat of a big release at the time. That I had never even heard of it, not even seen it mentioned anywhere. I'm like, maybe it was just one of those films that got left out by when Hong Kong was first becoming a thing that Americans and the English were really taking stock of their films, that they were like, yeah, maybe we just won't talk about that. another one that was like, I've heard of mentioned, but never really gone into at length, is the Long Arm of the Law series.
Yeah.
Now there's a whole bunch of these, but they only put the first two, which I'm told is kind of unfortunate because the third one I think is considered to be the best of the series, but not included here. This is from the sort of heroic bloodshed, mindset, you know, like the killer, that sort of thing. It's from that mindset of Hong Kong films, which it's definitely more of a drama. There's not as much sex farce. It's here, but it's, you know, it's not a big part of it. And each one of both of these films, all of them, there's no crossover characters. It's not this. It's totally different stories every time. And they're all sort of like tragic crime stories, basically.
And from what I was reading, and I've never seen A Better Tomorrow, but that apparently came out between 1 and 2. And they said that the influence of A Better Tomorrow was felt on 2.
Well, I totally believe that.
I found 2 more straightforward and what I would expect of a movie like this.
Mm-hmm.
One, I found actually even though two, like, you could make the argument that two is quote unquote better, but there's something about one that's kind of like a hangout movie, because it's like they're planning a heist and they're biding their time and they have like money to blow, and they're just sort of like, most of the movie is dedicated to them like kind of not getting along with each other while they wait for the heist situation to present itself.
And one is more bad guys who are genuine bad guys, right? Like, all the main characters are genuine bad guys, and what cops there are, we're not really following their story.
No.
It feels like it's missing like half the film, where it's like, oh, the story of the cops who are hunting these guys, but that's not there. This is the story of these really unlikable criminals.
Some of them are like who former are like, military.
Yeah,
some of they're disenfranchised.
They're Chinese guys. Both these films, I don't know about the later ones, but both these films are Chinese mainlanders who are like coming illegally into Hong Kong to do stuff. Whereas the second one, I think they were actually like ex-cops in Hong Kong, in mainland China, but now they're in Hong Kong working for the cops sort of undercover.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, you do this and then y'all get your freedom. I think the reason is because they were trying to escape mainland China. Yeah. And so now they're in trouble. But I actually like the second one a lot better than the first one of this, which is contrary to what most reviews I've seen say.
I was seeing that two seemed to be more popular, at least from
what
I was looking at.
Because most of the ones I saw were like, they're both good, but one is definitely the better formed film. And I'm like, I disagree. I think even the action scenes in two are much more engaging. And also it doesn't hurt that you like most of the characters in the second one.
Yeah.
You're like, okay, these are, it's got moments that are genuinely funny. You don't want bad things to happen to them, but that appears to be the way this series goes.
The transfers are different too. So like the second one looks
way better,
like way Blu-ray quality. The first one looks like 60mm film almost. Yeah,
it's terrible.
It looks like it was made on the cheap, which it was, but it shows.
Yeah, I agree. I think it took me out. That probably took me out of it somewhat, just how crappy it looked.
Yeah,
that transfer. But yeah, I think by the time I saw the second one, I was like, okay, I would watch more of these, but only now. But I wouldn't if I hadn't seen the first one. If only seen the first one, rather. I was just like, yeah, it looks so bad, and I don't like any of these characters, and I've seen much better heroic bloodshed movies than this.
I felt like the first one, Tarantino must have seen that before Reservoir Dogs. I feel like there were elements of influence in Reservoir Dogs from the first one of these, how it is just sort of like a bunch of guys, they don't know each other that well, but they're put in a situation where tensions run high and they're not friends. Like, you know, they're in it for a purpose, but they're not like buddies, but they're also forced by situation to spend inordinate amounts of time with each other.
Yeah.
And I appreciated that about it as well, seeing that Reservoir Dogs DNA in that first one.
No,
but you're right. The second one is a slicker. The second one's a slicker movie, and it's more conventional. I don't know. I just responded to the first one more. It just happened.
They both have their own series of extra features. There's two different cuts of the first one here, with very little difference in running time.
I watched Hong Kong on both.
I
didn't bother with the other.
I did. I always, unless I think it's I think it's Italian films. You always want to watch the export cut, because the Italian versions often have a lot of stuff cut out of them, whereas the export cut will actually have more.
Yeah.
Unless it's the British cut, which will have considerably. British cuts are always the worst cuts, because they cut out their whole video nasty thing. They were just like, at that point in the 80s, were like, just cut all the blood, just get rid of it. But it's got audio. The first one's got audio commentary by Hong Kong film expert Frank Zheng. Family business, interview with Michael Mack, the son of star Johnny Mack. From Hong Kong police to Big Circle gangs, interview with the screenwriter Philip Chan. Conversation with action director Billy Chan and screenwriter Philip Chan. Interview with Johnny Mack, archival piece. And then the second one has its own set. And this does come in a slip-cased box here. I'm still kind of baffled why 88 Films, which does such a great job with these all the Hong Kong releases lately, I would even say they're kind of the to-go place for Hong Kong re-releases from the 90s, that they didn't want to do a bigger set. Like, they just recently it put out a 4-film In the Line of Duty set, which was awesome. It's like, oh great, there's like probably 4 more of those too, but you know, 4 is the best one. After that, it drops off.
Yeah.
But this one has 2 different cuts as well. Another audio commentary by Hong Kong film expert Frank Zheng. There's Bringing the Action, director interview with director Michael Mack, Man of Action, interview with co-star Ben Lamb, Iron Fist of Crime, interview with stuntman Stephen Chan, and then the various trailers that come with it. Like I said, these are okay. I, as a huge Hong Kong film fan of the 90s and late 80s, I didn't feel like this is one I'm super, these are ones I'm super sad I missed, but I'm glad I got to finally catch up with them. But one of the ones I was actually really looking forward to, because it was one I always see written about it in books about Hong Kong, and like, because it was one of the few ones that starred Cynthia Rothrock, you know, American action star who came over there, who was literally phonetically reading her lines out. Didn't like the poor, there's a lot of extra features with stuff with her that's been re-released lately where she's like, I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. They're just like, just beat this girl up. Okay. Now read this. Like, just like it's written out here.
Yeah.
She's like, I didn't know what the movie I was in was about. But The Inspector Wears Skirts, another one, like there's like four of these. I'm like, no box set. Maybe the others are even worse than this one. Cause let me tell you, man, despite, you know, being produced by Jackie Chan, and starring Cynthia Rothrock and, Sibelle Hu, who also is kind of a major reoccurring female action star, this is basically just a bad Chinese police academy movie.
Or a good Chinese police academy movie.
I can't believe that you really mean that,
though. I liked it.
Did you really?
Yeah, I liked it.
Oh, man.
I had a lot of fun.
I thought this was
borderline. I knew nothing about this.
I thought this was borderline offensive.
I thought it was like, it reminded me of like the police story movies mixed with police academy. It's like an all girls, basically they're putting together like an all girls police squad. And it's an ensemble movie about these girls that are training to be police and all the trouble they get into and the nightlife stuff. A lot of it is like what they're doing after hours.
Most of it.
And getting mixed up with like the guys that are also cops, and like the rivalry between those, the romantic rivalry and the workplace rivalry. And then it's bookended by two pretty terrific badass action sequences.
The action sequences, which they bring back the two main female stars for those, they come in and they just rip up the screen and are amazing and show how great they were and how great the stunt choreographers were. But, you know, you were bitching about the Blue Jean Monster being like, it's got like 10 minutes of action and then the rest of it is just
comedy. Plot of this, so here's the difference. The plot of this is specifically about female trainees, and that's what you get to see. The plot of Blue Jean Monster is about an undead cop, and instead you see, why won't my husband have sex with me?
Okay, that's fair. But, like, also, I wanted to see an action film with female cops and not, like, I can't get these, our male co-trainees to stop grabbing my ass, which is what the movie is. It's, like, the guys plotting how can we grab their ass, and the girl going, I can't believe they grabbed our ass. That's the movie.
Well, I liked it.
Okay. I'm glad you liked it. I was very, like, what the fuck is this?
No, like,
especially after that opening, which is just super strong. Like, I've seen the opening cut into, you know, best of sequence things where you're like, oh, this is one of the all time great sequences. And it is. It's really good. And then after that, I'm just like, when are you going to do more of that?
I was always really dismissive of Cynthia Rothrock because I worked at a video store in the 90s. And to me, it was like,
oh, you saw some of her American
stuff. I just lumped her in with like Billy Blanks and like those. It's just like, oh, here, Michael Dudikoff. Like, here's another like chop sake, American crappy.
Oh, she was great, though.
It was like all those China O'Brien movies and stuff, but I'd never actually seen her in action. So I was dismissive just based on like, oh, it's DTV junk.
Yeah. I think it's, I forget which one of the In Line of Duties. I want to think, say it's maybe the second one she's in. I think the one that was called Yes, Madam, but, she's great in that as well. You're just like, wow, you're really, really solid. You've got the chops. It's just the guys who are making all those American ones, they don't know how to film action. You know, they're like, they film action with people who don't know how to do action, you know, whereas these guys are like, life is cheap. Let's just get this, you know, let's get these people who actually know how to fucking do martial arts and just have them shoot the scene. Okay, let's move on to the next thing, which meant a lot of actual physical connection.
Oh, there's like a guy in this that I don't know. I know that Jackie Chan has used a lot of Australian actors.
Yeah.
There's like a guy in this who is like a Caucasian with a flat top.
Yeah, he appears in quite a few films around this period because he is just incredible fighter. He was throwing
himself. I was like, he throws himself into a lot of that stuff. He made a big impression.
Yeah, he also is in the Line of Duty 4, which is the best of that series in my mind, which was one of the early appearances of, what's his name? Ip Man. Donnie Yen.
Oh.
Like, really, really, the fourth one is so incredible. All four of those are good, but Yeah, he plays this tiger style fighter. He's like, guy rips his shirt off and is like, beats shirt, let's go. Yeah. It's just like literally the guy's Donnie Yen's kicking him and he's just running at him, like taking it. Like, come on, do it. See this chest? You have no effect on me.
Yeah. I'll see that. I want to see that. I want to see more of these. I'd watch the other Inspector Wears Skirts movies if they're like this one. I'd watch them.
I honestly could not tell you the
they couldn't be any worse.
The rest of them.
Yeah, and I liked it.
Three sequels to this. So I don't know. None of them have their own Wikipedia page, which does not bode well for them.
Well, I don't have my own Wikipedia page, and I'm great.
Doesn't bode well for you, John.
Oh, shit.
I'm mentioned by name on a Wikipedia page. Does that count for something?
Maybe. Okay. Depends on the page.
Spill.com.
Okay.
We had to fight to get that page, for the record.
Oh, yeah.
In the day. Because, like, people kept writing it, and then someone at Wikipedia would take it down, and someone else would write it again, and they'd take it down. And finally, we had to, like, bring a case in front of the Wikipedia, I don't know, Court of Appeals or whatever, why it was a viable thing. And I'm told that we, and I forget, two other websites were the reason that they changed their rulings about having Wikipedia pages for websites.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
I'm on Know Your Meme, but I'm not on Wiki.
Does it? Well, that's cool. What's your
apparently
meme?
I was the first person to point out that Shia LaBeouf had plagiarized Dan Clowes when he made that short film. I don't know if you remember that. Shia LaBeouf had made a short film about a movie critic, and he plagiarized a story in 8 Ball, to make the film.
No
and
kidding.
I guess I was the.
I just reread all of 8 Ball recently.
Yeah, I guess I was the first person online to be like, I think this is from 8 Ball, and they mentioned me. They're like Twitter user John Golson.
Did you read
pointed it out?
Did you read his Clowes' last one? I think it's called something like Eleanor or something like that. I can't remember the name of it.
Oh, no, I haven't read
really,
any new
really
stuff
good.
In a while. I like his stuff, but I haven't read any new stuff in a while.
Anyway, this particular set comes with audio commentary by, hey, remember that name from the last set? Frank Jang. He's back doing another audio commentary.
Is this
here.
Also 88 Films?
It is also 88 Films. There's a interview with Cynthia Rothrock, which honestly, she's so great in interviews talking about this period.
Yeah.
Anytime there's an interview with Rothrock, watch it, because she's funny and she tells all these like sort of insider stories and like really is the one person who lets you know what it was like as an American just walking into this studios that had just exploded overnight in Hong Kong into this huge international monster, and what their process was and how it was so different than anything else. And just also incredibly dangerous. her stories are fantastic. There's a Director Wears Pants, an interview with the male director. There's the different English opening and closing titles, and then the trailers. But yeah, I mean, it's worth watching for the beginning and ending. I don't know. The rest of it, like I said, for me, didn't at work. I was just kind of like, this
going
felt
to the
like
roller rink, going like, to the nightclub. I liked all that stuff.
Felt like Police Academy 5 or something.
Yeah, know? It was great.
What? You liked the... Oh, wait. Are you one of those guys who's like, Police Academy movies are great. I don't care what
I think there's. I think there's a good one, and there's one...
Well, 1 and 2 are good.
Well, I think 1 and 4. I think
you
4
like
is.
Two?
I think 4 is like the best possible version of a Police Academy movie.
Okay, I don't think I ever watched past 3.
Okay, 4 is like 4 feels like it has an actual budget.
Is that Mission
feels,
to Moscow?
No, 4 is 4 feels like an action comedy. Like it has action sequences. It's the one at the end with the hot air balloon chase.
I don't remember.
Anyway,
even if I had seen it, I wouldn't remember at this point. I would have seen it when it originally came out. Then, so. Yeah. Yeah.
And it feels like they intended it to be the last one. Yep. Steve Guttenberg didn't come back after 4, and it right. feels... Anyways.
Yeah, but, the great Steve Guttenberg, yeah. The anchor of this series.
But I watched all the Police Academy movies during pandemic, because you know, I figured if I was going to die, I should go ahead and get that done.
I used to be friends with someone who lived in Hawaii with Steve Guttenberg and was his personal assistant. Like, lived in a house out right outside his house and was like, just his personal assistant, and said he was just great. Said he was like so cool, really, really nice, paid really well, was really polite. Was like, wow, I kind of expected him to be a douchebag, but no, he was a really cool guy. Nice to hear, right?
It's good to hear.
Yeah. I had my time. I was really into Steve Guttenberg for sure. And Steven Guttenberg adjacent films, like the great and truly underrated Moving Violations.
I love his printing press.
His what?
His printing press, the Guttenberg printing press.
Oh, shut up. You're a monster,
the
John.
Bible?
Well, that was
the Gutenberg Bible.
That was a bad move. Now,
he's one of those interesting
guys. The Gutenberg
guys,
government has apologized for the Bible on several occasions.
You have like these guys that like you can't track their trajectory. They just got cold. And he's one of those that's like, okay, the 3 minute of baby movies were like big hits.
It felt like the Cocoon.
And it's like Police Academy up to a point, and the Cocoons. Police Academy movies are profitable, but there's no downward trajectory of, oh, and then he was in this dud, and then his career went down the tubes. It was almost, it looked like Hollywood just stopped calling him.
Yeah.
Like cold.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Which is weird, because at one point he was like, he was a household name.
Yeah.
You know, like a big star.
Yeah.
Like he and Tom Hanks in the running for all the same roles.
Yeah.
Like referencing Bachelor Party, which is still deeply underappreciated. Do you like Bachelor Party?
I like Bachelor Party. And I didn't, it was always like super taboo growing up because it used to come on cable all the time. And so other kids in elementary school would watch Bachelor Party and you'd talk about it at school. Yeah, and
it was a
like,
hard R.
And it felt like, oh, it's like, It was I was not allowed to watch it, obviously. Yeah. But I was aware of it. I didn't watch it for the first time until like, I think, I feel like it's been like 10 years ago.
Oh man, I watched it when it first came out. I think I went through puberty because of that film.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's totally inappropriate by today's standards. Like, well, wildly inappropriate.
I think something Bachelor Party has going for it that is rare in 80s sex comedies is that the women get equal raunchy screen time as the men, because the guys are doing stuff and the girls are also off doing their own wild thing. And there's some equality in the raunch and shenanigans.
And also as having your lead star be like, look, I'll play along, but I'm not going to cheat on my wife.
Yeah.
You know, I love my wife. I want to be with her and I'm not looking to get away with anything here. You know, and all his friends are the ones who just want him to have sex with someone else. They want to have sex with other people, but he's like,
yeah,
just want to be with my wife. And you're like, that was kind of unusual for films at this time. That were usually like, as long as you get away with it, who's hurt? Anyway, we got away with this episode of Digital Noise, and the only people who were hurt was us from watching some of these movies. But what was the one that was the winner? What holds the Blue Ribbon Award?
That Warriors box set is like,
it's pretty impressive.
That's the one, right? Like that's the definitive. That's the one that you gotta buy. Like you gotta own Warriors in 4K.
Yeah,
just straight up.
Yeah,
just like everything else is a matter. And honestly, even on this show, I think it's obvious it's a matter of taste, because it's like,
sure,
this whole show I think has been, usually we're pretty simpatico. And this show, I feel like in particular, has been like, I really like this one, you really like this
one.
Well,
I mean, in the second half. In the second half. The first half, we were on the same page for everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, apparently with Hong Kong films. I'll loan you that in the Line of Duty series.
Oh, I would love to see it. If you have it, I'd love to see them.
They're fantastic. Yeah. If you like this sort of thing, then
and consider this my public apology to Cynthia Rothrock.
I'm sure she's listening.
Sure.
So, I guess we're going with the Warriors, even though the special secret pick of the week is the fifth thoracic vertebra.
Yeah, that's the like, don't let this person go the rest of their life without making another movie.
Yeah, fair enough.
That's the way I feel about that one.
Well, thank you for joining me, John. Do you have anything you need to promote?
No, I will say, I'm not sure when this is going up. If it's still, it will still be March. And Saturday nights at 8:30 PM at Cold Town Theater, we've been doing a sketch show that's kind of a play. It has like a through line and like one main plot called Transplantic City, written and directed by a friend of mine who got a lung transplant.
Oh,
and it's from the point of view of somebody who's had to go through life-threatening surgery.
From the point of view of his lung that got taken out.
But we've been running it every Saturday in March, and then we're doing it again, oh, like the third or fourth Thursday in April. It's getting like a one-off, but that's the only thing that I have. That's been like every bit of my energy over the past 2 months has gone to that show.
Fair enough. So, that and preparing for another Disneyland visit.
And preparing, oh, yeah, Disney World again.
Yeah, my mother got a corneal transplant recently.
Yeah.
And I keep, I think it's starting to annoy her. I keep texting her, can you see ghosts yet?
And?
No ghosts.
And?
Nope, no ghosts. Mm. Too bad, because busting will make you feel good.
That's what I learned when I turned 12.